This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have as my featured guest for the first hour, John Avery Emison, the author of The Martin Luther King Congressional Cover-Up, The Railroading of James Earl Ray, Pelican 2014. John, it's a real pleasure to have you here to talk about the death of Martin Luther King and the trial of James Earl Ray.
Glad to be here, Jim. I'm sure we'll have a good discussion.
Yeah, I'm simply delighted because this is a terribly important subject where I have not heretofore featured a guest. So I'm simply delighted you are here, John. We can begin right off with your first slide, if you'd like.
Be glad to, Jim. I want to emphasize that what we're the topic I'm going to be dealing with, we may chase rabbits from some of these slides, but the topic I'm going to be dealing with merely has to do with the alteration of the court transcript of James Earl Ray's guilty plea. There are numerous other extremely important aspects of this case.
John, you might want to elaborate. Believe it or not, most Americans have no idea that there was a trial in the case of Martin Luther King that yielded a guilty verdict, and it was not. I'm not talking about James Earl Ray.
Right, you're talking about the civil.
Wrongful
death suit.
That's right.
There was. I think that was in the 90s. And a jury in Memphis returned a verdict in favor of the King family that essentially the government was responsible for the death of Martin Luther King, and they asked the jury to award them a compensation of $1, which they did. But the jury heard that case; it certainly did.
Well, James Earl Ray, it's been evident to me for some time, was clearly a patsy as much as Sirhan Sirhan in the case of Bobby and Lee Harvey Oswald in the case of JFK. So I'm very, very eager to hear what you have to tell us about the congressional cover-up, John. Please proceed.
Yes, and let me preface my remarks, Jim, with an explanation about the about the origin of the title of the book, The Congressional Cover-Up, because there was a congressional cover-up. I'm talking about the one that was run by G. Robert Blakey, the House Select Committee on Assassinations.
During its reinvestigation of the deaths of JFK and MLK, yes.
Yes, and this was in the, as you know, and I'm sure your listeners know, from 76 to 79 was the House Select Committee was authorized to reopen both investigations, both the President Kennedy assassination in Dallas in 63 and the Martin Luther King assassination in Memphis in 68.
And the hearings were principally 77, 78, and then there was a delay before the publication of the final report, so Blakey could get all his ducks in a row in 1979.
Well, and there were a lot of fishy things that went on both sides of the investigation. Of course, we'll be concentrating on the Martin Luther King side here tonight. But I am morally certain, and I think I can prove to the level of the preponderance of the evidence that Blakey and the other primary investigators on the MLK side of the House Select Committee investigation knew they were dealing with a bogus transcript of Ray's guilty plea. They knew there were competing transcripts because as we get into the presentation here today, you'll see that the original transcript had been published. It was out there. And Blakey claimed to have absorbed all of that information and listed these sources in the bibliography. And then when I confronted him with this, and we'll see in the later slides, it's almost humorous, Jim. It's almost humorous. He lawyered up on me. Here, I'm not a lawyer. I have a PhD in resource geography from Oregon State University. So I've worked as an environmental scientist most of my life in radioactive and hazardous waste cleanup. I'm an amateur historian. I have a bachelor's degree in history. And I have connections in particular to this case. But here, a guy who was a full professor and wound up, I think, the dean of the Notre Dame Law School, lawyered up on me.
I think he's still there, John, if I'm not mistaken.
No, he retired about 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay, thanks.
He's out in Arizona.
All right, fair enough. Yeah, yeah. Well, I've been extremely troubled, too, by Blakey's efforts to pin the death of JFK on the mob, which was, of course, involved and supportive, but was far from the key reality of the situation, where Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover were the principal facilitators of the death of JFK. But we'll set that aside. It's been addressed many times on other shows here on The Real Deal. I'm very interested in what you have to share with us about Martin Luther King and the congressional cover-up.
Okay, so we'll just jump right into that. As I indicated, I gave this presentation last year at the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis. It was extremely well received. Pardon me, I'm recovering from a bit of a throat problem. The title that I put on this presentation is The Facts and Meaning of the Altered Court Transcript of the Guilty Plea Entered by James Earl Ray. And so I'm going to put up the second slide here, which has embedded in it, I hope it's going to work for us here, the about a two-minute clip of back in the day on the evening news, CBS, when Walter Cronkite cut in with the announcement of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Direct from our newsroom in Washington, in color, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite and Russ Hodge in Memphis, Tennessee, Dan Rather in New York, Bernard Kalb in Saigon, Marvin Kalb in Wellington, New Zealand, and Berquint in Khe Sanh, South Vietnam.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face. Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck. Police said they found a high-powered hunting rifle about a block from the hotel, but it was not immediately identified as the murder weapon. Mayor Henry Loeb has reinstated the dusk-to-dawn curfew he imposed on the city last week when a march led by Dr. King erupted in violence. Governor Buford Ellington has called out 4,000 National Guardsmen. And police report that the murder has touched off sporadic acts of violence in a Negro section of the city. In a nationwide television address, President Johnson expressed the nation's shock.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal killing tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence.
Dr. King had returned to Memphis only yesterday, determined to prove that he could lead a peaceful mass march in support of striking sanitation workers, most of whom are Negroes. Dr. King had this to say last night about the situation in Memphis.
Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest for right.
So that's our,
that was just sensational stuff, John. Yes. Unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, you forget that you've seen it. I'm sure probably when you saw this, Jim, you know, you knew exactly where you were, when you heard this news. And by the way, I grew up about 75 miles, northeast of Memphis in a small town in, rural West Tennessee. And, I've always had an interest in this case. So,
and of course, Martin had originally had his lodging in a very secure hotel in downtown Memphis, and they were harassed about not being in a black hotel and thereby moved to the Lorraine, which of course was intended to set him up to make him more vulnerable, more accessible for assassination.
Well, you're absolutely correct, Jim. And one of the documents that I discovered, I couldn't determine whether it had ever been published before, but I put it in my book, is an FBI internal memo in which the FBI lays out the public relations campaign that it intended to wage against the King entourage to shame him into staying in the Lorraine Motel. Now, the odd thing about the Lorraine Motel, and I don't think I have a picture of it in my presentation here, is that all the rooms face one direction. They face west. So if you have any sort of vantage point across the street from the Lorraine Motel and you can see any door of any room, you can see the doors to every room of the Lorraine Motel. So I have no doubt in my mind it was the FBI's effort to place Dr. King on that second floor catwalk.
Yes. I've long believed that J. Edgar Hoover was a driving force behind the death of Martin Luther King Jr.
So there were three major players in the story that I'm going to tell in my presentation here today for you, Jim. Of course, you your viewers will see Ray on the left, that's his prison number when he was, prison photo when he was incarcerated at, the Jefferson City prison in Missouri. And the center photo is, his second attorney once he was extradited from the United Kingdom. He was arrested over there, extradited. He was originally represented by the Haineses, Arthur Haines, Senior and Junior. This is Percy Forman, who was the most renowned, whoops, what happened? Okay, nothing too much that we can't recover from. That's good. And can you still see that, Jim?
Oh, yeah, we're fine, John.
Yeah, Percy Foreman in the bow tie in the center from Houston. And then the judge in this very brief guilty plea hearing that was conducted was W. Preston Battle, criminal court judge of Shelby County, Tennessee. So here were the main three players in this very convoluted and unlikely story. And there are three elements to what we're going to be talking about here today. What was it that was altered? What was altered? Number two, who did it? And number three, why did the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the HSCA, cover it up in 1979 and enter even more alterations? And the cover of my book is on the right there.
Well, the very idea that they altered the transcript is profoundly disturbing, John. I'm very, very troubled already.
Well, yeah, you're going to get more troubled as we get into this. Because let's look at the actual words that Ray was questioned by Judge Battle before Judge Battle accepted the guilty plea. There were certain questions in the law, fewer then than now, that any judge who was about to accept a guilty plea, particularly for a capital crime, murder, the judge had to establish the truthfulness and particularly the voluntary nature of the plea. In American and Anglo-American jurisprudence of the last several hundred years, you can't just beat a man or a woman, literally. You can't beat a confession out of them and have them utter the words and utter them once, and the issue's over with. The judge is there to protect the rights of the accused, even when he's standing there before the court prepared to plead guilty. But one of the main things the judge has to know is, did you do this voluntarily? So I have set side by side here the questions in the two transcripts, the legitimate transcript on the left and the doctored transcript on the right. And in Judge Battle's questions, he asked Ray, has any pressure of any kind by anyone in any way been used on you to get you to plead guilty? And Ray's actual answer that day was another question. He answered a question with a question. He said, now, what did you say? Well, Battle did not ask him to elaborate, didn't restate the question, didn't instruct him to answer the question. He just plowed right on into the next answer. I mean, into the next question that he had prepared to ask James Earl Ray. And Jim, I think much of the problem here is the police department, the sheriff's department, the Shelby County Jail where Ray was incarcerated, the court itself, the Shelby County DA, they thought they were minutes, at worst, hours away from getting James Earl Ray out of their hair. They weren't looking forward to a trial. They were all concerned that what is going to happen to this town if Ray is acquitted. And we'll get into some of the evidence later on. So they were in a rush to get this thing done. As a matter of fact, I determined, Jim, and it's all laid out, well documented in the book, that they actually rehearsed these questions with Ray the day before. So none of this, none of the questioning that Judge Battle asked of James Earl Ray, there was nothing spontaneous about it. This was sort of bad theater. It was already rehearsed. And they were so concerned that Ray was going to go off script. And that's why they rehearsed it. But when Ray went off script just a little bit, because he was supposed to answer the question, no. Has any pressure of any kind by anyone in any way been used on you to get you to plead guilty? The rehearsed answer was supposed to be one word. No. Next question. Well, when Ray answered the question with a question, Battle stuck to the script. He's the one who stayed on script. It was Ray who went off script. Battle stayed on script and just kept plowing through the questions. Now, if you look on the right-hand side of the screen, and both of these are actual reproductions of limited portion of the competing transcripts. And as you'll see, the transcript on the right was typed on a different typewriter than the transcript on the left.
Yes.
87-page transcript. The only change that was made, and it was made by the, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but the only change that was made in Memphis was this one line. That's it. Has any pressure of any kind by anyone in any way been used on you to get you to plead guilty? And the doctor transcript said no. No one in any way. So they knew they had a problem with the transcript left with Ray answering the key question on the voluntary nature of his plea with another question. So they changed it to this. That's the only line in 87 pages, Jim, that's changed. I've compared every syllable, every word of every line. And in fact, in the bogus transcript, all the other pages are the same, and only this one page with the one line change on it is typed on a different typewriter.
So yeah, that's quite shocking, especially when it turns out that line turns out to be so important. You describe it here as central and determinative in upholding the
validity of the guilty. And those are not my words. Those are the words of a federal judge who was ruling on the constitutionality of Ray's plea. Whether it met constitutional muster, was it constitutionally legitimate? And a federal court ruled that cited the specific line and said that it was that line was central and determinative in upholding the validity of Ray's guilty plea because it established the voluntary nature in the man's own words and words he never said. So let's go down to the next page. So, there's Battle on the left and, Sheriff Bill Morris, shepherding, James Earl Ray into the, that's a shot from, when he was first inducted in the, Shelby County Jail when they, took him off the flight from London, following his, extradition. So as we've indicated, Battle asked Ray a series of questions. and now we're going to listen to a forensically enhanced audio recording of the question to which Ray's answer in the transcript was altered. And these are the voices of Judge Preston Battle and James Earl Ray. Now, Jim, bear in mind as we listen to this, there were not only these competing transcripts, the legitimate one had been published twice before the House Select Committee was enabled to do their investigation. Plus, there was an audio, there was a recording of the entire hearing, which the House Select Committee apparently never subpoenaed from Memphis. So I think they didn't want the truth. I think that's the simple answer to that. They didn't.
That's very, very disturbing, considering this was a reconsideration of the assassination. In both instances, you would have thought they would have been supremely careful, very cautious about interpreting the basic evidence instead of displaying such gross dereliction of duty.
Well, I agree with you 100%. We'll get into some of the cause and effect of that in later slides. Now let's go to the next slide. And so I can play that for you again, Jim.
Yeah, sure.
It's Battle asking the question, is any pressure of any kind by anyone in any way been used on you to get you to plead guilty? Now, Ray asked a question. There's no doubt about that. The legitimate transcript shows that Ray answers a question with a question.
Really? Yeah, but it was, what did you say? And this is different than the original transcript, which says, you know, ask him, what did he say?
This is...
When I hear it, and that's what he says. I don't know what to say. Let's listen to it again, John.
Yeah, we'll probably listen to it two or three times. I've listened to
it. Sure, go for it.
100 times if I've listened to it.
Go for it.
And some people tell me, younger people, perhaps with a little better hearing than I have, there's a disagreement. Ray either says, I don't know what to say, or I don't know what to think. In either case, it's not an answer. He's right. Answering a question with a question. We'll listen to it again. I'll turn this up just a tad bit. Well, at least I think we will. Here we go.
Has any pressure of any kind by anyone in any way been used on you to get you to plead guilty?
What's your judgment, Jim?
I think it was, I don't know what to say.
I don't know what to say. I think that's what he says.
Yeah.
So the judge says, by the way, have they pressured you into pleading guilty? He said, well, I don't know what to say about that.
That's pretty odd to answer all by itself, too, John.
Pardon?
That's an odd answer to get from him in any case.
Well, of course it is. They were expecting him to say no. They were counting on him to say no. They had 1 foot in the state trooper squad car to take him to the prison in Nashville when this thing was over with, and Preston Battle just blew right past this. You want to listen to this again?
Yeah, sure. One more time.
This is the voice of Preston Battle and James Earl Ray.
Has any pressure of any kind by anyone in any way been used on you to get you to plead guilty?
He obviously did not answer the question.
Sure. No, of course he didn't. Yes.
So
the transcript was obviously altered to say no, no one in any way. Yes.
Oh yeah, yeah. No. There's no way he said that.
Right.
And so the crux of the issue here is, did the court establish that the plea was voluntary?
And the answer is obvious, it did not.
The answer is no. Just as plain as the nose on your face. The court did not establish whether Ray's plea was voluntary. And in fact, it wasn't voluntary because he was coerced by his own attorney, Percy Foreman. Now, let's run through a little bit of the timeline because...
it's a good idea. Go through the timeline. Yes.
People need to hear this in order to get the full picture of what's going on, because this is a case literally unlike any other case in American history. So, of course, the assassination was on April 4th, 1968. Ray was arrested at Heathrow in London in June of 68. He had been into Canada. He successfully escaped Canada for Europe. He'd been in the United Kingdom. He'd been in Portugal.
All of which requires considerable financial resources, John, and it's not obvious where they derived.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And if you want to get into the intelligence community aspect of this, maybe on a later program, we need to go over his aliases.
Yes.
That's mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling that he had four Canadian aliases. In other words, there were names of four actual living Canadian men who lived within a five-mile radius of each other in Toronto. And they all were raised, approximately raised height, age, build, weight, hair, and eye color. When you look at an array of the four of them, they look like brothers or cousins. But we'll leave that for another day. So, pardon me, Ray was arrested. Sure. He was extradited in July and brought back to the Shelby County, Tennessee jail in Memphis in late July.
Babel was found dead on March 31st before the transcript was certified?
Oh, yeah. So,
John, that's staggering all by itself.
Well, and there was a mystery, and Jim, there was a mystery visitor, but they never established the identity to his office the afternoon they found him dead in his office. But that's probably another whole part of the story too. So Ray went into court on March 10th, 1969. So this is 11 months after the assassination to plead guilty, represented by, Percy Foreman, who absolutely betrayed Ray and violated all of the professional standards of attorney-client relationship. The very afternoon that this hearing was held, certified reporter who was an employee of the criminal court clerk's office in Shelby County typed up this transcript and released it. And as you can imagine, there were throngs of reporters, writers, radio guys, TV stations, you know, hanging around the courthouse, hanging around the courtroom, wanting to get their own copy of the transcript. So they reproduced they completed the transcript, reproduced it, and released it the same afternoon. This original transcript shows that Ray answered the question about whether or not his plea was voluntary with another question rather than than an answer. So here all this information about what he said is out. Scores of reporters around the world have a copy of it. It winds up in two books right away. So they took him from Memphis. They took Ray from the Shelby County Jail, where he was incarcerated under extremely rigorous circumstances. He had studio lights on him 24 hours, 7 days a week, had that for 7.5 months. He wasn't even allowed to use the toilet without being under direct observation of a jailer. So, he pleads guilty March 10th. They rush him out of the courthouse, transfer him to the Tennessee Highway Patrol. They take him to the state penitentiary to begin serving his life term, the main penitentiary in Nashville. He gets to sleep in darkness for the first night in 7.5 months. then he wakes up 2 mornings later and writes a letter to Judge Battle saying, I'm firing Percy Foreman and I want to recant my plea. I'm not guilty and I want a trial. Battle received these letters. Battle unfortunately died on March 31st, before ruling on these letters, and before the transcript was certified.
Were the circumstances of his death suspicious?
They are to me.
I mean, looks, the timing is just incredible.
Well, the timing is incredible. He died, he was found face down with his James Earl Ray file open on his desk in his office. And the man who found him, who was an assistant DA working on the Ray case at the time, who subsequently became a criminal court judge himself, told me that the light was off at the end of the day when he found Judge Battle in his office. Now, Battle hadn't been reading the Ray file in the dark. So who turned off the light? It's very, very suspicious circumstances. But for our purposes here, the transcript was not certified. And under Tennessee procedure at the time, it was not clear at all. Apparently, this situation had never come up before. Tennessee procedure has been changed so that in the event a judge dies, there is a specific procedural process by which a transcript must be certified anyway. But that really wasn't in place back then. So Ray's new lawyers that he hired were able to get a hearing scheduled for May 26 before Judge Arthur Faquin to consider his request that he withdraw his plea and go to trial because he wanted to plead innocent. And so it was at this May 26th hearing that the first bogus transcript shows up. And it's obvious that the Shelby County DA's office doctored that page because they introduced it as evidence.
John, did any of the reporters catch this discrepancy?
No, nobody did.
Would we have more time? We have about 12 minutes remaining to cover.
All right.
And I look forward to having you back, especially when you're not suffering from a cough. But, John, please do tie together.
Yeah, okay, we're good. So how do we know the Shelby County DA's office is the one that altered the transcript? Okay, well, we know because I ran down the retired Shelby County Criminal Court clerk, James A. Bubba Blackwell, and his deputy clerk, Charles Coster. Both of them are retired. They were in charge of making the audio recording. Coster was certified court reporter, and he's the one who actually typed out the transcript that was distributed. And two of the authors reported the transcript verbatim in their books with Ray's answer of equivocation about whether or not his plea was voluntary. The transcript says, now, what did you say? Which is similar to, I don't know what to say.
As I hear it, he actually said, I don't know what.
Right. So this book came out. Clay Blair Jr., he was in the courtroom that day. He's dead now, unfortunately. On page 210, he has Ray's non-answer answer. Now, what did you say? Jim Squires, who wrote this book with John Siegenthaler, they put in the book on page 128. Now, what did you say? They had the transcript too. The Clay Blair book was out within weeks. They already had this book typeset, and they were waiting for the guilty plea transcript to add as an addendum at the end of the book.
Probably the longest part of the book.
Well, it might have been. And so Siegenthaler, who was a well-known guy even at that time, they had the transcript right. Now, when I interviewed Bubba Blackwell at his home in Collierville, Tennessee, and he's in his 90s now, he walked out. He said, you know, the only thing that I took out of my desk that pertained to James Earl Ray, when I retired after 30 something years as a criminal court clerk, was this transcript. Would you like to see this transcript? That's a copy of a copy that was made the day, Ray pleaded guilty.
And that's exactly what you wanted to see.
And it's exactly what I wanted to see. And so I asked him to sign an affidavit. He signed an affidavit. This is what the transcript said. I've got an attachment. You'll see the attachment refers to Exhibit 1 in just a moment. And we didn't change it in our office. You know, he didn't want to be under that onus. The DA back in the day at that time has since died. And so the same thing, Charlie Coster, he typed up the transcript. He says, I typed it up on one page, on one typewriter. I didn't make any alterations at any time. This is what we distributed to everybody who was there and wanted one. And here's Exhibit 1 of the original. This is the original page with the question at the bottom. Has any pressure of any kind by anyone anyway been used on you to get you to plead guilty? And they show that Ray answered the question with the question. He didn't answer the question with an answer. And so we come along a number of years later. Blakey proudly proclaims that in the bibliography that we absorbed the entire bibliography. Guess which books, Jim? He says they absorbed Clay Blair's book that had the original transcript in it, the unaltered transcript, and Siegenthaler's book had the unaltered transcript in. That's in the bibliography that they said. So, you know, there are a number of ways that the House Select Committee was likely compromised. Blakey didn't know it until decades later that George Joannides was involved on the JFK side of the assassination. But it's important also for the MLK part of it, because the intelligence agencies were also involved in this assassination as well, I argue. And so so we'll go on. Here's Joannides. He's the guy who ran, unknown to anybody, on the Warren Commission or on the House Select Committee, either in the 60s or the 70s, wasn't known until the 90s. He ran the Cuban Front organization in Miami that outed Oswald as a Castro sympathizer.
Well, this guy is one of the few files held back by the CIA, even after the passage of the JFK Records Act, that created a five-person civilian board entrusted with the responsibility to declassify documents from the CIA, the FBI, the Secret Service, the Office of Naval Intelligence, and so forth. The right. CIA has withheld the Joannides file, which is a very serious violation of the intent of the JFK Records Act. I regard it as a clear indication of the CIA's intransigence in releasing information that would, of course, implicate the CIA itself in the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, I have no doubt about that. I agree with you. Well, here's the, you can see the Clay Blair on in the left-hand column. I've got item number 8. That's the Clay Blair book. This comes out of the final report of the House Select Committee. And then page 297, also the bottom item there is the John Siegenthaler book, Search for Justice. Both of these had the legitimate transcript in it. I mean, there's no mystery here. They just ignored it. So when I caught up with Blakey a couple of years ago, and I asked him a series of questions, whether the House Select Committee was aware that there was a discrepancy between the transcript of Gay's, Ray's guilty plea that was distributed to news reporters the very day and then accurately reported by a number of them, and the subsequent transcript used by the House Select Committee to evaluate the constitutionality of Ray's guilty plea. I get this lawyered up answer. You're going to get a big kick out of this, Jim. If it existed and it was material, it was not in any event brought to my attention. Does that sort of remind you of what was it, Schultz on the on Stalag or whatever that?
Sergeant Schultz.
I know nothing. You know.
Yes.
And who was assigned to read these titles? And. Why did they ignore this stuff? If it existed and it was material, it was not in any event brought to my attention. There's more. I'm just getting you 2 pages of this. I had several pages of these. Are you aware that there's a discrepancy between what the final report says James Earl Ray said in court and what you've got in volume 3 of your appendix volumes, which implicates Ray even far more than the original alteration. I get some more lawyering. If it exists and it was material, it was not in any event brought to my attention.
Shameful. Absolutely shameful.
On down. Now, the one decent guy.
Now, was he responding to you orally or in writing?
In writing.
So you have what, emails or something, letters or something?
I got emails, sure.
Yeah, okay.
I got emails.
So how recently was this?
This is in 2013. This is not ancient history.
Okay, please, yeah.
I mean, he knows the truth of the matter now, that the legal analysis that he commissioned for Ronald B. Adrian to do.
But he's not lifting the least digit in order to take any step to correct it.
Of course not. Of course not. Of course not. Now, Adrian told me, he's the chief judge of the municipal court in Cleveland, Ohio. Now, Judge Adrian told me, he said, look, he said, they gave me essentially a box of stuff. And they said, here's the James Earl Ray guilty plea. Go write up an analysis of whether or not it was valid. He said, they didn't give me time, resources, or commission me to find all the evidence that might pertain to that question. They asked me to look at what they handed me and make a decision about it. And Adrian even equivocated, which is a little beyond the scope of what we're doing here and a little more complicated. But even in the final report, Adrian equivocated rather than saying in the absolute sense that Ray's guilty plea was valid. So why the congressional cover up? Jim, they didn't have anybody else. They had nothing. They had a handful of nothing if they didn't have Ray. So we've already talked about Joannides.
Yeah, you can elaborate on these, John. We have a few more minutes. You can elaborate on these.
Okay. So
go back to one. I mean, it seems to me the proper procedure would be admit that they'd made a mistake and that a crucial aspect of the case remains open as a consequence, and that there appears to have been malfeasance in the office of the district attorney who provided the manipulated transcript. I mean, this is all very serious stuff because you're talking about the assassination of one of the great leaders of the American people.
Well, we're talking about the people in the investigatory process, the DA's office. We're talking about the Tennessee Attorney General that represents the state in federal court. So when Ray exhausted his appeals before the Tennessee Supreme Court and the prosecutors lied before the highest court in the state and committed felonies there, then Ray's lawyers appealed to the federal courts. And the Tennessee AG's office, I'm reasonably certain, probably in ignorance.
Now, I would dare say that Joannides' involvement with the HSEA was principally to cover up in the case of JFK. MLK was just a spillover.
I'm sure, Jim, but one of the things we haven't talked about here is the number one CIA guy who I'm convinced was involved in the King assassination operation.
Yes.
James Jesus Angleton.
James Jesus Angleton, yes.
Yes. So I think Joannides was there for both of them. This was just the soft underbelly of the two. But
you must tell me more about Angleton's involvement here and why. Was he convinced that Martin Luther King was a traitor to the country?
Oh, I think what we didn't know then, what the House Select Committee didn't even have before it, when they went through their play, is that at the highest levels of the national intelligence organizations, they believed that Dr. King was going to pronounce the war in Vietnam as unrighteous, and he was going to tell black teenage boys and going to tell black soldiers
not to serve,
lay down their weapons, don't register for the draft.
Yeah.
You know, And
powerful stuff, and he was being bugged all over the place, so they would have known his thinking.
Not just the FBI, and right. not just the CIA, both of whom were spying. The Defense Intelligence Agency was spying on him. The Office yes. of Naval Intelligence. These guys practically had to elbow their way past each other to plant their bugs. There were so many of them.
John, we have only a few minutes left, but please do proceed. Yes.
Okay. So here's the whole deal. This was reversible error. If a court had the legitimate information before it, if it had had Clay Blair's book or Siegenthaler's book showing that when the court accepted Ray's guilty plea, the court never established the voluntary nature of it. That's reversible error. They would have had to put Ray on trial. Can you imagine the chaos that would have caused at the national level with the intelligence agencies if the storyline that they had been selling for years simply evaporated.
Yes. Yes.
I mean,
tell us about Judge Donald B. Adrian.
Well, Adrian was a young lawyer who had been hired by Blakey, and he had been commissioned to perform this legal analysis of the constitutionality of Ray's guilty plea.
So he was working for the HSCA as a special consultant?
As a regular employee for some fairly brief period of time, I think.
Okay.
But he indicated to me that he was not given the resources or the authority to go out and find all of the evidence that might pertain to that. He said they gave me the last week or two of December of 1978 when the committee was literally shutting down. It was going to go out of business on January 2nd, 1979, when the new Congress was inaugurated. Its yeah. mandate was over with. He actually performed this analysis and turned it in to Blakey after. And Blakey accepted it and put it in the report. The central most important part of the MLK investigation was whether or not Ray should have gotten a trial. And the committee was already disbanded, and Blakey put it in there just as if the committee had voted on it and the committee had never seen a word of it and never considered a word of it.
Yeah, this reflects very badly on Robert Blakey, I'm very sorry to say. John, it's wonderful that you are able to join me today. Is there anything you'd like to add in the last minute that remains?
Oh, glad to be here, Jim. Love to come back sometime and talk about Angleton and the
yes.
and the aliases. I mean, it's a mind-boggling story.
You can count on it, John. We'll do it. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, John Avery Emerson, for being here. His book, The Martin Luther King Congressional Cover-Up, The Railroading of James Earl Ray, is available from Pelican Books. Stand by for the second part of today's program.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the Empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off and leave them off.
Say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen in.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
You're from. My name is Henrik, and we are glad to have you with us listening today. Red Eyes Radio is the name of this investigative online radio program. Questions is what we ask, and answers is what we seek, no matter where it may lead. We cover everything between heaven and earth, beyond and below. If you want to find out more and listen to more topics and programs, please visit redeyescreations.com. Today we have writer, former journalist, artist, and musician Ola Damegård with us to discuss his book, Coup d'etat in Slow Motion, a book that turned out to be a very important but dangerous task for him. In his book, Ola uncovers the real facts behind the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme that took place on the 28th of February 1986 in Stockholm. It has interesting similarities with the JFK assassination. He'll discuss an international conspiracy of what is still claimed to be the deed of a madman but has turned out to have its roots within the international military complex and world finances at the very highest level, all sanctioned locally from behind impenetrable veils. We'll talk about the life of Olof Palme, unofficial and the official story, in an effort to try to figure out why he was targeted and what the deeper geopolitical ties are. All right, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Ola. Nice to have you with us. First of all, thank you for joining us all the way from Spain. Good to talk to you today. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. And I feel honored to be with you and the rest of the guys on this website.
Excellent. Thank you for that. We have, of course, a very interesting topic ahead of us today, something that I've been interested in for a long time, the murder of Olof Palme, something that happened when I was about 6 years old. I do recall some of the things from the event of where I were at the time and everything surrounding. We're going to get into detail about this, of course, Ola. But first of all, tell us just a little bit about yourself. I want to hear kind of how you got involved in this, how you got interested in this particular murder, if you will. So give us some of the backstory here.
I think it all started when I was a kid. I was born in Denmark, and my family was very much involved in the Danish resistance movement against the German occupation. So my whole life I've been hearing about how to stand up for the truth and how to uncover lies and how important it is to stand up for what is right. And then when I was about your age, when Palme was murdered, I think it was like 5 or 6 or something like that, John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and I remember the shock, the impact it made on my family, and also with the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember when the whole world was sort of afraid of what was going to happen. So it made a real impact on me, these things. Then many years later, it was the first time I saw the Zapruder film, when I discovered what happened around the Kennedy assassination and how many lies there was involved in that around the official version. So I got, I would say, almost like obsessed trying to find out what the hell had happened there. And so I started reading. I think I read like a couple of hundred books. I was so, so into it. And from the John F. Kennedy assassination, I started getting interested in the assassination of his brother, Robert Kennedy, of Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, and so on. And after a while, I started seeing that it was almost like there was a pattern between these different assassinations, how a group that was ordered to commit the assassination by a very high force, political, economical force, how they could do away with a person like that, how they could get away with it. And I started seeing, like I say, a very clear pattern on how it was done. And after a while I was doing this, the Palme assassination happened. And to start with, I, like everybody else, I thought, oh my God, it's a one lone crazy guy who shot Olof Palme, because that was what everybody was told.
Yeah.
And I thought that the Swedish police were honest, and I thought that thank God I'm in Sweden, where everything is white and pure and clean and no problem, they're going to sort this out. And then the more the time passed by, there were things that I reacted, and I thought, what is this? This is very strange. There were more and more lies coming up, obvious things that they said that didn't make sense. And then after a while, I started seeing parallels to, like, the Kennedy assassination and the other assassinations. And with the other assassination, I had made like a list, almost like a template how to do it, because it followed, even though the circumstances were different at the, for the different assassinations, there were very big similarities. So with the other assassinations, I had like point 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, how to do it and get away with it and trick people into believing the official version and then let it just disappear so that nobody would really notice what happened. And then I started seeing, oh my God, the Swedish assassination followed more or less exactly the same dots in this template. And that really freaked me out because I was able to, predict things from looking at how the other assassinations were done. One time I said within 2 weeks, the so-called investigation are going to come out and say this, blah, 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 blah. And within the next 2-3 weeks, they did. Mm-hmm. And by then I knew, whoa, 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 something is totally wrong here. And that was when I really started digging into this assassination.
Now, tell us a little bit about the book and how that came to be. And you obviously have been working on this for a long time. When was it published, first time?
It has never been published.
Never published?
I put it up on the internet now for free because for so many years I tried to get it published and no one has dared to touch it.
Okay.
I've had it with big publishers and they've just freaked out. I had it with Michael Moore's agent and he said if you publish this or whoever published this will be sued from here to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And he called it a truth bomb, a bomb of truth. And so it's this is why this year I came to a point where I said the most important thing is that the truth gets out there. So I put it out for free to download from the internet. And I just spread it really quick to take the pressure away from me, if you understand what I mean.
Sure, sure, definitely.
And so it got spread around the world within hours. And I just checked now, this is like 2 weeks ago, and there's like 1,200 people who've downloaded it so far.
There should be more. We're going to do our best to get the word out, of course, because it's a very important message in the book. And what I like about it as well is that it dovetails with so many other events. We're going to get into this later, but I mean, it connects somewhat with the JFK assassination, if nothing else in pattern. It goes into the Iran-Contra affair. The NATO situation in Sweden with their, you know, so-called neutrality and everything else. So it's very, very deep, you know, in its connections and tentacles. But the book was never published, you said, but how long have you been working on the book for? About
15 years.
Well, yeah. And did you, and during this time, have you continuously just worked on the book and updated it, or did you pretty much finish it and then try to just get it published a few years ago, or how did that work?
No, I tried to get it published while I was writing it as well, but then it came to a point, like you know, you have interviewed a lot of people who are digging into the truth of what is going on globally, and so you're very aware of it. It's quite dangerous as well when you start digging too deep. And it came to a point the year 2000 when I had two friends of mine who died in strange ways. And I just felt, well, I need to go somewhere else. So that's why I moved to Spain. That's one of the main reasons. And when I came here, I finished the book here. I think I finished it in 2001 or something like that. And since then, more or less nothing has happened, so I haven't updated anything hardly. It's still the same version, more or less, because the power elite behind this assassination have succeeded in getting people so tired of hearing about it, of all the different theories, and so nobody really cares anymore.
Yeah, it's true. We've seen this in the media. People get kind of tired of it, and they begin to make jokes about it, and it becomes another just conspiracy theory to throw away. But why don't we set the groundwork here a little bit, Ulla, for those who've never heard about either the murder or the Prime Minister itself? What would you like to say about Olof Palme, and I guess the the climate in Sweden at the time, and then later we can go into how things changed and everything. But let's talk about Palme a little bit first, and then obviously what happened, how he got killed, the official version at least.
Okay. The official version is that Olof Palme was a very just man, he was a protector of the weak, the poor. He was a man of the people. And he was a man, a politician, a very controversial politician that were, on an international level, was sort of opening up doors to stop the big conflicts between the superpowers. He was also embracing, like, Castro and the many different of the smaller countries, and also like PLO and these different conflicts where no other international politician was welcome. The doors were open to him. That happened after in 68 that he stood up and went in a demonstration together with a Vietnamese ambassador in Stockholm, and they were demonstrating against the horror that the American army was doing in Vietnam and so on. That made him internationally well known as somebody who stood up for the weak people, sort of, so to say, up against the big bullies. I need to say, though, that the more you look into Olof Palme as a person, and when you look into his career and you look into what he was up to, what you see is a very double-faced person. You see one with the official version that as soon as the shots were fired that night and he died, he turned into a martyr of unlike proportions, like JFK. He got silver wings and a glow, you know, like it was like hallelujah.
Right. Yeah.
that had nothing to do with him before that, I would say. And I have quite a lot of theories about how that happened and what was going on there, because after he died, you were not allowed to raise any critical finger or point at anything, because then you were sort of harassing the dead.
Right.
The dead, you know.
Almost in favor of the murder if you criticize him for something.
Yeah, no, you cannot. Now it's changed a bit since so many years has passed on, but the thing is that once you start digging deeper into him, his career and background, it's a very, very, very strange background. He comes from a very upper-class bourgeois family in Stockholm, very right-wing, and he did his military duty and within the, what do you call it? I'm sorry about the English words. I'm not sure sometimes, because sometimes it's difficult with the Swedish titles and so on to translate them.
No worries.
Anyway, I can say about what happened with the assassination of the official version. The official version is that the night of the assassination, Olof Palme and his wife, Lisbeth, they decided to go to the cinema, and they had said to the bodyguard that he didn't use his bodyguard very often, because up to the assassination, Sweden was a white island where no violence, it was like everything was wonderful and so on, contrary to other countries. And one of the things that amazed other people, other nationalities, was that the prime minister could walk around in the streets with no bodyguards, no threats, no nothing. Of course, that changed very much after the assassination, but up on that evening, when a few hours before they went to the cinema, he told his bodyguards that there was no need for them. So in the evening, he went to the cinema together with his wife and his son, Morten, and his girlfriend. And they went to central Stockholm. The prime minister, Olof Palme, he was living in the old town in Stockholm. So they walked to the subway station and took the subway into the central Stockholm, where they met his son, Morten, and then went to see a two-hour-long film. When that was finished, they decided to split up from his son and girlfriend, because they wanted to walk home to where they were living. And the Prime Minister and his wife decided to walk home. It's about a kilometer to where they lived in the old town. So they walked down Sveavägen, which is one of the main central streets in Stockholm. They walked down the street, and a few minutes before he was shot, a person was observed on a corner. There was an art shop called Dekorima. At that corner, this person who later shot him is said to have been standing waiting for them. And then when the couple came walking down the street, this guy, the shooter, he came up behind them, grabbed his left shoulder and fired off a shot right into the back of the Prime Minister, who dropped more or less dead at the very instant he hit the ground. His wife, Lisbeth, who was walking to the right of him, the official version says that she was pulled down when he fell, because they were holding arms. So she was pulled down, and the shooter then tried to shoot her as well and fired a second shot at her that officially just touched her very, very lightly over her back. Then the shooter stood for a second or so, just checking that everything was the way it should be, that the Prime Minister was dead or dying, and then took off. He ran into the... there's a small little alley that he ran down, and then up some stairs. There's about almost 100 steps up where he ran up, where he was seen by a few witnesses, and from there he disappeared. And the description of the hitman was the first description when you check out what the witnesses says. Is that it was a man, he was about 35 to 40. Nobody saw his face. They saw that his head was a little smaller than normal to the body, like you see sometimes bodybuilders have, and that he was very fit and fast running,
mm-hmm.
that he had a dark jacket going down to the knees or something like that, and most probably gray trousers. And some kind of cap or hat on. So nobody saw him at all, his face. No description was given up. Anyway, that is the official version that he took off.
Mm.
Later, it is said that this was done by a lone crazy guy. And they blamed it. They even got a guy sentenced for the assassination. A man, his name was Christer Pettersson, and he was a local drunk, narcotic, with quite a lot of violent background. He had killed another guy on more or less on the very same spot, a few hundred meters from the site of the assassination. He had killed someone there with a knife some years earlier, and this guy was, they said that the reason why he shot Olof Palme was that he mistook him for his drug dealer, and that because they had the same fur cap, and he shot him by mistake and ran off. And that is more or less the official version to this day, that there was no reason, that it was all a mistake, and that it was done by this a lone crazy guy called Christer Pettersson, who is now dead after being... Well, I can go get back to that.
Sure, definitely. No, but he's an interesting character, the way he comes along. And he's a patsy, obviously. He's set up, and yet this is what we're being told to swallow. Where in this process do you begin to become suspicious? Is it during when the official version of this is laid out, or is it later when the investigation is supposed to begin here? Where should we go next?
Christer Pettersson is very, very late down the road. He's like 2 years after. He was not the first. They tried to pin this on several people before that. But if you are used to seeing and studying these kind of assassinations, it's very, very interesting to see how it's done. And one of the main things that you have to be aware of is that, like, for instance, if I go down to central Stockholm tonight, I pick up a brick and I throw it into a window. Within 2 minutes, I can guarantee you there will be police cars there.
Mm-hmm.
There will be, if I start making, or if I start shooting, there would be like, what do you call these, combat squads. There would be
police teams
cars everywhere.
Yeah.
I would be grabbed and taken and boom, 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 within minutes. But when it comes to these big hits, when you know, this is one of the signs that you know that there's a conspiracy behind it, is that nothing happens. All the normal procedure is out of place. You know, it's taken out. And this is exactly what happened that night. There's so many strange things happening within the first few hours. All of the witnesses that I need to rewind a bit, because what the official version said that it was a lone crazy guy that just walked up, shot him.
Mm.
But what the witnesses said was there was more than 100 observations of people with walkie-talkies. There were lots of observations of police cars that was officially not on duty that evening. There were witnesses who identified some of the people with walkie-talkie by name, and the whole setup with the it's so complicated and complex, so it's not hard to I'm not really sure where to begin.
I know we can detail this further, Ulas, we make sure we explain this to people. Obviously what you're saying first of all here is that someone, and this is, as you said as well, recognized in other situations like this, someone in a position of power basically removes the normal level of protection that should be there during those circumstances, or the fact that someone in a position of power just basically removes the police that are supposed to be sent out or whatever.
Yeah.
Take us through a little bit more of this, of what actually happened. If we have obviously witnesses that are seeing all these weird things that are reported on. What happened with these? Because eventually these are kind of filtered out and we don't hear from this. What do you think happened, first of all, to these witnesses that might have been at an instant in the beginning that they, you know, were able to testify and tell their story, but they're later removed, right? They're not there to provide their testimony.
There's about, as far as I know, there's somewhere between 50 and 200 observations of walkie-talkies around the assassination site, down the streets, on parallel streets, around for the weeks before the assassination took place, outside the house where Olof Palme was living.
Mm-hmm.
There were many, many people observing, like two, three people, outside in the street of where Olof Palme was living. They have been, the description, everything has been given to the police. People saw them, they heard them speak a strange language. It was like English, but with a German accent, or a strange, they couldn't really understand it. They were also around where the assassination took place a few hours later. Walkie-talkie people were observed, like they were checking out the site before how they were going to do it.
Mm.
They were when they went to the cinema. There were two people following them. Two of these people, of the walkie-talkie people, followed them. They were observed there by witnesses. They were observed on the subway train into Stockholm. And when they went into the cinema, there was one man placed outside the entrance. He goes under the name the Grand Man.
Mm-hmm.
Grand is the name of the cinema. And quite a few people saw him standing there with a bit of the nervous staring type of thing, because he was put there to make sure that the Prime Minister did not get out, you know, because this was the perfect evening for this to take place, because by following him all the way from his home, then they knew for sure that he did not have a bodyguard with him, that he was on his own. And then when they entered the cinema, they knew for sure that he was going to be there for an hour and a half at least, meaning that everything could be prepared at the same time while they were in there.
Right.
So meanwhile, when the film is being played, there are observations of these many of these different police cars. Many of it's both official police cars and civilian police car with technical equipment in the back seat and stuff like that. Some of them with fake number plates, you know, fake number plates because it's not the same at the front as in the back.
And, right. Mm.
And also they are standing very openly with their walkie-talkies communicating. And this is also a sign where you see with these other big assassinations that they know that they are covered. They don't fear that they would be taken by the local police. You know?
Right, right.
They know that they can get away, that they will be helped to get away. So they're very confident. There's no hiding.
I want to comment on this as well. To me, it's very interesting that it seems that it's actually a pretty, although it's well executed, it seems like they're not sure of what they're doing. That they're kind of fearful that this might not be pulled off. Hence, they have so many extra men on site and everything. It's similar to when you begin to investigate other false flag terrorism attacks and other assassinations as well. That there's like an overabundance of attention and people present just in case. So in one regard, we could say that sure, it's a well pulled off assassination because they succeeded, but at the same time there seems to be a lot of insecurity about it as well. So when we begin to examine it, we can almost see that, wait a minute, maybe it's not so well thought out, or maybe it's not that incredibly well, it might be planned, but what I'm getting at is that they're very, very fearful that something potentially could go wrong. And if that's the case, then of course the whole cover would be blown on this thing. Hence, maybe that's why they have so many men in different positions, Ulla, so they can actually make sure that the job is done. But it looks really weird when people and witnesses are seeing all of this, you know?
But I don't agree with you at all there, because what is also standard with these big hits is that you have more than one operation going on at the same time, and they don't know about each other. So you have like 3-4 different operations. Often it can even be training things like in London and in 9/11 you had also these different operations going on at the same time, mm-hmm. meaning
yeah.
that they're pointing at all different directions, so that when somebody like myself is trying to sort of find out what is going on here, it's just pointing everywhere, and the people involved only know their own little part in it. They have no clear overview, so that you have all of these people involved in something that they don't really know what's going on. Mm-hmm. They only know their part. It's the need-to-know chain, as it's called. The CIA use it all the time. I know you, you know your sister, but I don't know anyone but myself, and so on.
It's a point well taken. It's a diversion, and no one really knows what's going on. And as you say, if one begins to investigate, you might find multiple layers of different people involved in different operations, and this is also part of the cover. I guess that's one of the points I wanted to make, that this is why in some cases eyewitnesses they're thrown off, because everything surrounding the situation is so weird and almost to the point of bizarre that they can't explain what's going on, basically.
And also it makes everybody sound like they were crazy when you thought, yeah, but I saw this, I saw that.
Right.
I said, yeah, come on, you know. Be real. You've seen too much, you watch too many movies. But the thing is, the movies are often based on the real, not the other way around. The thing is that not even the people doing it are aware of the big whole scheme. You know, the people who shot him were just mechanics, you know, assassins. And when you look at the big assassinations like this and other political big hits as well, very, very often, it's not always, the hit team have no idea where the order comes from, mm. who ordered him dead. They have absolutely no idea. They just know their little part. They know that they've got a description of the person they're going to hit. They might not even know that it's the prime minister. They don't know about the rest of the group. They have one contact or two, so it's often like a group of two or three people connected with radio. They're in the months before the hit or the weeks before, they're being moved between apartments and houses and safe houses, and they don't know about each other even. It's all organized from one central point where all the teams are sort of working together, where a small little group have an overview of the hit itself, and they don't even know where the order comes from. The people organize it. They just have been given the order and carry it out. So it's very, very complex. It's very hard to really get into finding the real truth. It's a lot easier to find out who the people were who carried out the assassination than finding out who ordered it.
Yeah, yeah.
And these are the guilty people. They're a lot more guilty than the people who actually did it, in my opinion.
As you're saying, some of them might not even know what they were doing. I mean, that's guilt of itself, I guess, to a certain degree of being part of something you don't know what it is. But that's another story. Has anyone on the inside, as far as you know, actually talked about this, a police officer or someone who's been involved in a training exercise who knows that something weird is going on, but at least they know that they weren't part of the actual, or they were not the one who's obviously, you know, pulling the trigger in that sense, but they might have been part of something, yeah?
Yeah, quite a few people have been talking. The thing is also with the assassins or hitmen there, it's the people who are proud of what they did. You know, it was a historical hit. And then when you're proud, if you're not super, super, super professional, you start bragging, you know? You can't keep it to yourself. And when people get a little drunk, they start talking, and this is exactly what happened here with some of them, the people who were involved as well. So quite a few people have come forward and talked about their involvement. And it's by these people that when they get drunk or so and the rumors start flourishing about, oh, this guy was involved, that guy was involved, or they start talking about it openly because they also know that they will not be prosecuted or anything. These are the things, the jigsaw pieces that can give someone like me a possibility to start putting together a puzzle, getting a bigger picture. And for me, over the years, I had absolutely no idea about the magnitude of what I was getting into when I started. And it's been like making a jigsaw with the picture side downwards that I was sort of getting the pieces to fit together, but I had no idea about what the picture would be, if you understand where it was first.
Yeah, yeah.
When certain parts of it was fitting together that I could turn it around and see the picture itself.
Do you want to give us a little hint of the picture that you've begun to formulate here and where the connection goes? I mean, obviously, we do want to get into detail about who did it, what the reasons were, how things have changed consequently and everything else. But what are some of the connections? What are some of the picture here, the picture that have emerged to you?
One of the ways these big things are carried out is that you have a hit team, and it's more or less always put together by people. There are right-wing former policemen, security, soldiers, mercenaries, assassins, professional assassins. They're put together from different groups, different countries, with no apparent connection between them. With the intention of making it as difficult as possible for someone to find out how it's connected, yeah. So the hit team itself is put together like that of people who don't know where the order came from. Like I said, the order come from a very, very, very high position. Because they are the only ones who can get away with this. Because you need to control the justice system. You need to control key people in in the media, you need to control, keep people in the justice system, in the police departments, all of these places to get away with a thing like this. And also one standard component that is also always there is that the people who carry out the assassination have their own investigation on standby. So you have created a patsy before the hit, someone you're going to blame it on, and you prepared a lot of evidence and things that to point at this poor guy or group or whatever it is. Then the week before the assassination, you start pumping out in media that this group, ooh, they're really strange and they have weapons hidden, or it used to be they're like it's almost like there's fashion trends within the patsies. You know, it used to be that they pointed at Russians or East Bloc agents and stuff like that. Then after that, they started with now we have the Muslims. As soon as you're a Muslim, ooh, if your name is Muhammad and you have a dark mustache, great terrorist. You know, you can pump. It needs to look good in media. And after now Muslims is getting a bit out of trend because people are getting more and more aware. So now they started doing it like more than Scandinavian looking. It could be one of our own.
That's right. Yeah.
So now the next trend here is that it could be anyone.
Anyone is the terrorist. No one is
anyone.
Safe.
Anyone. And yeah. And the whole point is with these actions is for us to beg for more control, you know?
Yeah.
It's the three-step rocket, problem, reaction, solution. It's the same one they pull off again and again and again.
That's
where
right.
The one in power creates a problem. Nobody knows that he is the one who created it. It could be a bomb or 9/11 or Oklahoma City or the Madrid bombing or London or whatever. They create a problem to create a reaction. So they pull off like a bomb in the middle of a city. You need to get a lot of good pictures out in media, like horrible pictures. It's no good with old guys or pensioners or something like that. No, children, nuns are one of the favorites. Nurses, great. You know, so that you can really get awful pictures out in the media to create a reaction from the public saying, oh my God, something needs to be done. And then they will come up and give you the solution saying, oh, but you have to understand to be able to stop a thing like this, we need to, and then they will come with their solution to the problem they created themselves.
That's right. It's like Sandy Hook and gun control. They're doing
the same thing. Same again and again. I don't even look into them anymore because it's sort of like, oh my God, here's another one.
Yeah.
It's just standard. You can see it like they try. They say, let's see, the plan is I'm in power. I want the military to just be able to kick in anyone's doors. I want tanks in the streets. I want whatever. If I just put it there, if I was the prime minister and I just put it there in the streets, I would get a lot of reactions and problems with demonstrations and reactions from everywhere and criticism. So instead, I create this problem. A bomb somewhere, nicely done. I pump out in the media, ooh, this group over there, they're really weird. You know, it could be, who knows, maybe yogis or the bird lovers or something like that, you know, militant bird lovers, something stupid like that. They start pumping that in media and then boom, they pull it off, the bomb in a central city somewhere, point right away at this group of bird lovers, militant bird lovers, and say, to get the reaction, and people say, oh my God, what, please help us. And I say, yeah, but the only way I can do that is by pulling in tanks in the street, by being able to kick in anyone's door, and so on. And people say, please do it. And so in comes the tanks, in come whatever, boom.
The police take the surveillance cameras, anything they need
to. There
you
go.
Yeah.
And And they do it again and again and again and again. And all of these so-called school shootings or terror attack. I don't even know if there is such a thing as a real terrorist after all of these years.
Mm, yeah, I know.
I don't think so, you know, because every single time you can track it back to the same group again and again and again.
People are generally pretty peaceful, I think, and pretty calm unless something is really, really, you know, wrong somewhere. And
people are beautiful. They just want a normal, happy life with family and friends. It doesn't matter if you're in the middle of Tehran or if you're in downtown Stockholm or wherever. People are great. But there is a bully. There's a bully who's trying to mess it up for everyone.
That's right. And then you get Operation Gladio and things like that coming out of it. But let's go back a little bit more before we, we're going to take a break here in a little while. But let's talk about the investigation some more and what happened there, because there's a lot of interesting people involved, and as you said before, even main investigative, police chiefs and everything else have tried to figure out what actually happened. Mm-hmm. They've run into a cul-de-sac. They can't continue. They don't realize what's going on. They might be in a position of being a main investigator for a while, and then they're not involved in the case anymore. But again, the idea of the confusion, I think you explained it pretty well, that no one really knows what's going on, and even people in positions of power cannot get any straight answers from anybody mm-hmm. what's going on. So either that means that there's a lot of people involved that know what's going on and actively covering up, or as you said before, they are basically not in the know, but they know sufficiently enough what they should or shouldn't say so they can confuse people. But the investigation, what happened, and haven't we found out more at this stage?
Do you know there's a reason why they killed people like Kennedy in an open street? Why they shot Palme in the open? It would be so easy to just drop a pill in their coffee or something like that if they just wanted them dead. But what they want is to send a shock of fear, a shock of terror in the corridors of power, saying that we can get anyone, anytime, anywhere. That's why they do it in the open. And this is what has created this conspiracy of silence, because very few people know the details, but they know the power behind these hits. And they also know that if they could take him, who am I?
So they do it to silence people, send a message. Let's get into some of the other connections here as well. And what Palme was involved in at the time, as you said, he was very active on the international scene. He was almost more involved there in a certain stage than in the Swedish politics. And this dovetails with things like NATO, what was happening in Europe at the time, but also the weapons trade. Bofors, the big weapons manufacturer here in Sweden, was involved. It even connects in with Iran-Contra. Can you sort this out for us? What's going on here at the world at the time?
It's not easy.
It is not easy. Sorry about that.
But like I said, Olof Palme was a man that officially was standing up for the weak and the weak countries and so on. But at the same time, he was working for the big business, massive business. I'm sure you presented the Bilderberg Group and the Elite in many of your programs.
Sure.
Yeah. And also, Olof Palme was a Bilderberg member. He was a member of the Committee of 300, who is trying to centralize the whole banking system and control the world. He was deeply, deeply involved in the building up of the Stay Behind in Sweden, the NATO's ghost army that was developed in all the different NATO countries, Western European countries. And at the same time, he was a man of the people, and it's quite confusing.
That's a contradiction, exactly. Well, let's talk about that a little bit.
It's a total, total contradiction. But there was a lot of people suspecting that he was like a double agent, and I would say that he was at least that, because the official version of this taking, opening the arms for all the poor and the defenseless and so on, that was one thing. But he was using that to open the doors to countries like Cuba, to with opening the doors to PLO and other countries like that. At the same time, that he was all the time working for the power elite, the money, big money. And at the time of his death, he was deeply involved in a weapons transaction with India that he pulled off,
mm-hmm.
where it was, I can't remember it was like the biggest arms deal ever. And please remember, Sweden is supposed to be a neutral country.
Yep.
A neutral country. We're not talking like England or France where you can say, okay, fine, if you want to be part of a war, no problem. But Sweden is neutral. But we had this weapons factory called Bofors that it has come out over the years that they've been involved in a lot of illegal trading where Sweden manufactured weapons but sold them to so-called green countries.
Mm-hmm.
They were unofficially labeled green and red countries. The green countries were countries that was not at war, where the weapons were just used as for defense and so on. But the real buyers were so-called red countries, which were countries like Iran, Iraq, all of these other countries that was at war with other people. And what Bofors did was that they sent the weapons to a green country. In the green country, the papers were switched. So because the first green country was allowed to sell to another green country, and then it went to another green country, and bump, 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 from country to country until it came to one where they could send it to
a
so-called red country.
Yeah.
So it was sent. It was mostly paperwork because the money went straight. The weapons went straight to these
red listed countries. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And we're talking about massive amounts of money. And many people involved, many people involved as well. And big bribes.
And there's been scandal after scandal, by the way, as well, of these bribes. People in Sweden who are, you know, members of the board of Bofors and other companies as well, ABB, and it goes on and on from there. Yeah.
And many people have died around that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, being taken out one by one. All the key people are dead. And also Rajiv Gandhi, who he made this arms deal with, he was killed as well. So it's a dangerous business to get into.
Indeed, and I just wanted to comment and say this as well, that this is, after all, good old Swedish tradition, I think. If we go back to the Second World War, Sweden, specifically the Wallenberg family, who were, owned the SKF, the ball bearing factory at the time. I mean, they were selling it to both sides of the war. They literally were keeping the wheels of the war running during the Second World War.
Yeah, for sure. I would say when we come to Sweden, there's a massive dose of double morals. You know, like it's not a country with a clean conscience.
No, that's for sure. Now, in a little while here, we're going to take a break. I want to get into, in the next segment here, I want to get into a little bit more about the deeper connections, obviously, of who is the spider in the web, what your theory about that is. And there's a lot of connections more that we haven't got to yet. I want to ask you about propaganda due down in Italy and the connections with the old man George Bush and everything as well. So it just goes on and on from there. But let's give out some details about the book and where people can go to find it, Ulla. Let's give out your websites and basically just tell people where to go when they want to read the book and pick up more information about yourself. So please go ahead and mention all the things to get that out there.
Okay. One of my websites is www.oledammegard.com. That's OLEDAMMEGARD.com. And this book is called Coup d'etat in slow motion. Coup d'etat in slow motion, because that is truly what I believe happened. It was not just an ordinary murder, but a coup d'etat in slow motion that took place over a long time so that nobody really noticed what was going on. It started with the shots at Svea Wegen, but it continued to over the years, and now the country, Sweden, is so, so different to what it was before the assassination. Anyway, on that site, I've got... I'm quite multifaceted, so I got many on my different things on that website. And also, I put the book there to download for free with a donation button if anybody would like to support me, because that would be very appreciated. But it's there to be downloaded for free, both in English and Swedish, because I believe that the main thing is that the truth gets out there.
All right, very good. We're going to obviously have the website linked up as well. So in case you have a little bit difficult spelling Ulla's name, we'll have that up there for you. So check out redaspirations.com and just go there, and you'll have the link. And then also, by the way, as Ulla said, go ahead and download the book, read it, and if you enjoy it, if you like what you're reading and appreciate some of the connections that are made in the book, and there are a lot of them, by the way, as well. I want to mention that again, 800 pages. Do go ahead and support Ulla in his work so that he can continue and, of course, feel some appreciation for all the hard work that he has done for the book as well. And it's excellent. Yeah, go ahead.
Can I just say also that don't swallow what you read, you know, without criticism. Do not do that. Check it out. Read it. Make up your own opinion. Check it out yourself. Make your own investigations and then see what comes up. And if you see what you read in the book and if you find that as being the truth, then please spread it.
Very good. Stay with us, Ulla. We'll take a short break here. We'll be right back with more. We continue with the sketchy, delayed events following the aftermath of the assassination, including the investigation, witness accounts, and inconsistencies. Ulla's research led him into a world of international assassinations, arms smuggling, acts of terrorism, weird suicides, pedophiles, and Freemasonic rituals. He'll discuss a picture of Sweden rarely seen before. RedIceMembers.com is the members' website where you can get full access to our archives and the second hour of this and any of our previous programs. We are in our eighth year right now, and we have a treasure trove of material waiting for you. Acquire a membership from 3 months up to 2 years. We have a few different options available for you. Before we proceed, I want to let you know that we have Byron Belitzos with us next to talk about the Urantia book. After this, Jeremy, the alien scientist, Mikael Jalving on his book Absolute Sweden, the big brother of Scandinavia. We also have Josh Reeves on the lost secrets of ancient America, Mark Safer on the wizard Nikola Tesla. We also have Bill Donahue, Paul Levy, William Henry, and Robert Tindall. Thank you for listening. Don't miss hour two, our continuation with Ulla Dammegård on the murder of Olof Palme, coming up next.